The year was 1750, approximately. The place was Venice, Italy. Venice, Italy was a multicultural city, very much like New York nowadays, although in some ways different. And it had a very flourishing Ashkenazic community and a flourishing Sephardic community. And each community had its own Rabbonim and its own Batei Din. And one day, a dispute broke out amongst the Ashkenazi rabbis in the community. Shavuos was approaching, and the universal European custom was to recite Akdamos in the middle of Kriyas HaTorah. In other words, that the Kohen would say his bracha, Asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim v'nasa lanu es toraso, baruch ata Hashem nosin ha'torah, and the Baal Kriya would say, Amen. B'chodesh ha'shlishi l'tzis b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim b'yom hazeh ba'u midbar Sinai. And then someone would begin to read Akdamos. And many of the rabbis in Venice challenged this practice during that time period, and they said it's not right to interrupt in the middle of Kriyas HaTorah. It's an interruption. You're not supposed to interrupt in the middle of Psukei Dezimra, Birchos Kriyas Shema, Shemoneh Esrei, Kriyas HaTorah. Also, there's not supposed to be interruptions, no talking, right? not while the Baal Kriya is reading, and not in between the Psukim. And so these rabbis wanted to change. They wanted to change the placement of Akdamos and to read it at some other point instead, presumably at the point where we read it nowadays, before the Kohen even begins to make the bracha of Asher Bachar Banu.
So, Rebbe, a question. Why did it begin that way? Why did they have to begin?
Okay, that's part of what this controversy began to unearth.
In the Maftil they do it.
Okay, one second. That's a separate question about why we do it in Haftorah. We're not supposed to interrupt in the middle of Haftorah either. The other group of rabbis said that, you know, this is an ancient custom. It's been going on for centuries already. Presumably, the people who initiated the custom knew what they were doing. And even if we don't understand what they were doing, we shouldn't just throw it overboard, because we have tremendous respect for the great ones who initiated all of our customs. And the Ashkenazic Beis Din was deadlocked on this issue, and so some of the Dayanim of the Ashkenazi Beis Din decided that they were going to turn to the Sephardic Beis Din to resolve the question. However, there was one rabbi who was opposed to referring the question to the Sephardic Beis Din. He said, the Sephardim don't say Akdamos at all. So they don't have sufficient appreciation, right, for the beauty and the meaning and the background of Akdamos to give a well-considered, you know, ruling on the issue. In fact, this rabbi phrased it a lot more sharply. He said, kol ha-chashud ala davar, aspect of neglecting Akdamos. So lo dano velo meido, he's not allowed to judge a case. If you're a suspect of not observing a particular practice, so then you're not allowed to be a judge when that particular practice is up for judgment. So they said the Sephardim don't say Akdamos at all. How can they judge where Akdamos ought to be said? And so this rabbi, he was a minority, I think, but he sent a letter to his relative, who was Rabbi Ephraim HaKohen. I'm not sure whether he was from Vilna or from Budapest. He was in different places at different points in his career. I'm not sure the exact date when this letter was sent. It's signed Vilna, so I'll assume that his relative, Rabbi Ephraim HaKohen, was in Vilna. Rabbi Ephraim HaKohen might be familiar to some of you as the grandfather of the Chacham Tzvi, great-grandfather of Rabbi Yaakov Emden. And he was a massive halachic authority. Again, towards the end of his life, he was the chief rabbi of Budapest, or of the city which later became Budapest. And so his brother-in-law was the rabbi in Venice who objected to referring the question to the Sephardic Beis Din. And this brother-in-law sent a long letter to Rabbi Ephraim HaKohen asking, please issue an injunction and don't allow the Sephardic Beis Din to rule on this issue. Now, the Rabbi Ephraim HaKohen in his Chuvos Shaar Ephraim sends back a long response, which is very, very critical for understanding both the ability of Ashkenazi poskim to rule for Sephardim and Sephardi poskim to rule for Ashkenazim, right, as well as his understanding is incredibly relevant and foundational for the questions of Minhagim and keeping Minhagim versus changing Minhagim. I don't want to go into those dimensions of the Tshuva right now, but he sent back as well a response that was more relevant to understanding Akdamos, understanding the themes of Akdamos, understanding the theme of Kriyas HaTorah and Shavuos, and understanding how the two of them interact. Before I present the response of the Shaar Ephraim, I just want to mention that there are actually four different reasons that are given for how this custom originated, the old custom of saying Akdamos in the middle of Kriyas HaTorah. So I'll just to give you a sense of perspective, and I think that this range of opinions should sound very familiar, right? Based on what we discussed last week, the conceptual possibilities very much resemble the conceptual possibilities which enable us to interrupt in the middle of Birkos Kriyas Shema. But let's go through, survey some of the reasons that were given. So the most intriguing reason to my mind, and I need somebody who's a better historian than myself to follow up on this, but it's quoted by the Eliyahu Rabbah. The Eliyahu Rabbah says that he found in an ancient German manuscript, Ksav Yad Ashkenazi Yashan Noshan, that he says he found the following, that there was a great miracle that transpired in a desert. And this miracle was what inspired the composition of Akdamos. And therefore, they felt that it was only appropriate that Akdamos be read sometime after we mention a desert. When do we mention a desert? Bachodesh HaShlishi Letzeis Bnei Yisrael Me'eretz Mitzrayim Bayom Hazeh Ba'u Midbar Sinai. So Midbar Sinai is the end of the first pasuk of Shavuos' Kriyas HaTorah. So they decided that because there's a desert there, that's where we'll put Akdamos in. So that's what's brought down by the Eliyahu Rabbah. You'll notice he's not justifying it on the grounds of the poetic beauty or the mystical secrets contained in Akdamos, but rather he's saying that it has to do with the fact that somehow the theme of Akdamos, deserts have something to do with Akdamos, that integrates with the theme of Kriyas HaTorah, or of that particular point in the Kriyas HaTorah of Shavuos.
Very relevant.
Right now, I wish I knew what this story was. I spent about an hour last night on Bar Ilan doing searches for articles that might possibly shed some light on what miracle transpired in a desert that inspired the composition of Akdamos. I was not able to find anything, so I'd be very grateful if anybody is able to find that for me. But that's
Near Lyman. You ever speak with him?
I should speak with him. Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Well, what's the meaning of the word Akdamos?
Introduction. I think.
Akdamah.
Yeah. Like Akdamah. So that's one reason. Now you'll notice that this explains why Akdamos, or why the Kriyas HaTorah of Shavuos is consistent with the theme of Akdamos. It does not necessarily explain why Akdamos is consistent with the theme of the Kriyas HaTorah on Shavuos. You would think that deserts are pretty tangential, right, to the main ideas contained in the Kriyas HaTorah. Even if deserts are central to Akdamos, but they're relatively peripheral to the Kriyas HaTorah of Shavuos. And so this is not the easiest explanation to swallow, because in Kriyas HaTorah, so good, Akdamos is all about a desert, let's say, right? But the Kriyas HaTorah is not. And so what justifies interrupting Kriyas HaTorah, right, for something that seems to be only peripherally relevant to it? That's the explanation that's given by the Eliyahu Rabbah. There are a lot of parallels. I want to analyze Akdamos inside. That's why we have Siddurim here. But let's just go through a little bit more of the background in terms of why it said, approximately where it said. So a second reason that's given is given actually by somebody in the Kolel Chazon Ish in Bnei Brak. And he wrote an interesting article where he said that we know that that it used to be that people would translate. They would translate every pasuk as they read the pasuk, and they would translate it into Aramaic. And sometimes, he says, there were introductions for the translation, and those introductions were appended to the first pasuk that was translated. Hence, so this is Rabbi David Yitzchaki from the Kol Chazon Ish of Bnei Brak. He says he thinks that initially, and obviously a translation of a pasuk is not an interruption. Right? It's not an interruption because you read the pasuk and you translate it. And then the translator asking permission or giving an introduction is not an interruption because it fuses organically with the translation. So he thinks that originally the Kriyas HaTorah of Shavuos was read pasuk by pasuk and translated into Aramaic, and that Akdamos was the introduction or the Netilat Rishus, just like on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, the Shliach Tzibur is Notel Rishus before he says the Shmona Esrei, right? Hinni, right? So the same thing is that it used to be that the translators, the Matur Gemanim, used to ask a Rishus, and the Akdamos is the request for Rishus. That's why more we'll see in the first few lines of Akdamos, it seems to be asking again and again, I'm frightened, right? Ani mimas, I'm frightened, and I'm asking you permission to begin this awesome task of translating the Aseres Hadibros and the Psukim leading up to it. So he suggests that's what explains the necessity for begging people's permission and expressing one's fright and awe at the prospect of engaging in whatever he's about to engage in. He also explains that is why Akdamos is written in Aramaic rather than in Hebrew, because it was an introduction to the Targum, which was in Aramaic. So that's Rabbi David Yitzchaki's pshat. Again, it sort of fuses organically with the themes of the Kriyas HaTorah on Shavuos. There's a third explanation that's given by a number of Achronim. I think that Rabbi Yaakov Emden seems to hint at this explanation. There are others who say more explicitly. And that is, they argue that the theme of Akdamos is Kavod HaTorah, is how important the Torah is. And consequently, there's no more fitting thing to integrate with the Kriyas HaTorah of Shavuos, which is all about the Nesinas HaTorah, God's giving us a Torah and how precious the Torah is to us. There's nothing more fitting than a poem like Akdamos, which is all about the Kavod HaTorah. So again, as we go through Akdamos, we'll have to see whether that is the theme. It's true that the last line of Akdamos says that God, right, Tzvi v'Isvi Ivan, right, Umesar Lan Oraisa, that God desired us, He loved us, He wanted us, and therefore He gave us the Torah. But the other 89 lines of Akdamos seem to focus a little bit less, right, on the Torah, and so we'll have to consider whether we can somehow explain that the entirety of Akdamos is simply a lead up, right, to that last line, and hence the entire poem can be described as a form of Kavod HaTorah.
You mean it's like a prologue, is what you're saying?
Not a prologue, but it's sort of like a climax. The last line will be the climax, and the remainder is necessary for us to appreciate the climax properly. And finally, the fourth interpretation that's given, that seems to be the interpretation of many other Achronim, I think Rav Yaakov Emden alludes to this as well, and that is that Akdamos is such a holy and important poem that gives us so much insight into the realm of angels and the world to come and the importance of being Jewish and various other things like that, that it's so important that you can justify interrupting almost anything for Akdamos. It's just such an important poem. It contains so many basic foundational things about you could justify putting it anywhere. Right? That's so they talk about it in the connection with the krovets that we say on Purim. Krovets, right? We say that in the middle of, anyone familiar with the krovets on Purim? When do we say the krovets? In the middle of the Shliach Tzibur Shmon Esrei. That's really strange, right? Shmon Esrei, if there's anything that we're not supposed to interrupt. Right. Well, Yotzros are the middle of... that's also the middle of Shmoneh Esrei. Exactly. It's all part of the same thing. They say that all of these things, the Yotzros, the Krovets, they all have so many important Kabbalistic secrets, whether we understand them, whether we don't understand them, that justifies interrupting even Shmoneh Esrei and Birchos Kriyas Shema, regardless of whether it's thematically appropriate or thematically inappropriate. But it's just so important that we can put it almost anywhere, which is a very interesting line. It seems to resonate with the conceptual possibility that we discussed last week, that it's all D'oraisa versus D'rabbanan, pursuing Nisa versus non-pursuing Nisa. It's all a question of the relative importance of what's being said and what's being interrupted, not as much about whether the themes integrate or whether the themes don't integrate. And so you have that entire range when it comes to Akdamos as well. Just one last point before we actually embark on an exploration of Akdamos, and that is a point that Rav Yaakov Emden makes, which I think is also very consistent with the number of things we've encountered over the last few weeks. Rav Yaakov Emden, again, disagreed with his great-grandfather. His great-grandfather, the Shaar HaChaim, who was referred this question in Venice, stood up as a champion for the existing custom. He said that he thinks that there's a good reason why Akdamos is recited in the middle of Kriyas HaTorah rather than prior to Kriyas HaTorah, and therefore he says he does not think that Akdamos should be moved. He thinks that the community, the Ashkenazic community in Venice, should abide by their long-standing custom and they shouldn't change it. Rav Yaakov Emden felt that people should change the custom. He felt that that Akdamos should be moved to before the Kohen says the Brach on Kriyas HaTorah. Thank you so much. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech haolam shehakol yehiyeh bedvaro.
Amen.
He felt that it should be moved, but at the same time he sensed that there was a little bit of a dissonance, right, between his position and the position of his ancestor. He felt that there was a dissonance between his position and the widespread custom. All the communities in Europe were still saying Akdamos in the middle of Kriyas HaTorah. So Rabbi Yaakov Emden gives a very interesting explanation. He says, it's true for the earlier generations, it was appropriate to interrupt Kriyas HaTorah for Akdamos, because for them, understanding all of the secrets and the themes and how everything interconnects, so for them Akdamos was really an awesome experience. But for us, Akdamos is a set of words that we break our teeth over, and it's easier to fall asleep than to try to understand them, unfortunately. And so for us, Akdamos doesn't quite do the same thing as it did for the earlier generations. And consequently, says Rabbi Yaakov Emden, that it doesn't, for us, we can't justify interrupting Kriyas HaTorah for Akdamos. It was only the earlier generations who were actually able to concentrate on it and appreciate its depth that were able to interrupt. But that being said, right, it's a real, very sad state of affairs that whether you're davening at the early minyan and so there's a tremendous temptation to fall asleep, or whether you're davening at the later minyan and the temptation is not so big, but the Akdamos is almost inaccessible to us, and it's very tempting to daydream or to do something else during Akdamos, and that's not how it should be. Rabbi Yaakov Emden testifies, right, that there is a tremendous depth and a tremendous meaning and a tremendous profit that we can gain, right, from meditating and understanding and contemplating Akdamos, and it's a little bit of a pity. I'm just speaking for myself. When I get up to read it, or when I open up the sidur to listen to it, that so much of it goes over my head, and I figure that maybe we could actually pay some attention in advance, right, to the words of Akdamos, so that we can approach Shavuos with a greater appreciation for one of the jewels of Ashkenazic liturgy that we say at that time. So in the Art Scroll of Siddur, this is the Nusach Svarat Siddur, page 334, in the Art Scroll, Tfilas Shlomo Siddur. It was probably 18th century. The way that some poskim write is that the old communities should observe their minhagim, but if you're starting a new community, you should start it with the minhag of saying Akdamos before. And so it had to be that the older communities, sort of as they phased out, so then the new, or as they had more, rabbanim who were a little bit, more into, making the custom in accordance with their understanding of halacha. So they would have changed it up. Historically, I think that it took place over a while, over an amount of time. I'd have to check in Europe, like the real old communities, like Breuers or the community. I'm not sure. I'd have to check. Does anyone know what Breuers does? Yes, I'm not sure about.
Just in defense of the Sfardis minute, they say as aot of Rabbi Shimon and Eben Gibor, which is the entire 613. So. They don't have Akdamos, but they have something else.
Okay, does everyone have Akdamos open in the Siddur? Okay, so I'm going to ask you just for a minute or so, just look at Akdamos and tell me what's striking. Is there something striking about the arrangement of the couplets, about some sort of repetition, anything else that seems to be striking about the language, the vocabulary, etc.? Just to give people something, your mind works very, very quickly. Let's give everybody a chance to just take. What do you find striking? Right? Again, not as a expert in Aramaic vocabulary, but as a person who's unfamiliar with most of the words of Akdamos, just what seems to be striking and what would strike a person, even not being familiar with the complex vocabulary. Ta, excellent, right? That's the milah mancha. It's over and over and over again, repeated ta, 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 ta. So we have to figure out what the significance is of this ta. Now again, al pi pshuto, right? The simplest thing is to say that it's the feminization of a particular noun or verb, just like in Hebrew, right? You have, you can have tzvi, and you can have tzivya, and you can have every feminine, noun or verb will end off with either a taf or a yud-hei, and in Aramaic it's sort of combined and it turns into a ta, Right? But obviously, the Paitan did not have to emphasize it to the degree that he emphasized it, without giving it extra, you know, he's investing it with a tremendous significance, and we have to figure out what the significance is. What else is very noticeable about the structure of Akdamus?
It's going
it follows an Aleph Beis acrostic. Now let me ask you, just follow along, is the entirety of Akdamus an Aleph Beis acrostic? No. So the Aleph Beis stops at a certain point. Does anyone know where the Aleph Beis stops? Yeah, the Aleph Beis stops on page 335. I'll tell you, of the 45 stanzas of Akdamus, the Aleph Beis, which has 22 letters, it stops at stanza 22. And so we have basically Akdamus is practically split in half. The first half of Akdamus, the first 22 out of 45 stanzas, have Aleph Aleph, Beis Beis, Gimel Gimel, Dalet Dalet, and then the last 23 stanzas have a mishmash of letters, except that the mishmash of letters actually spell a message, a bracha, or a pledge on the part of the author of Akdamus. So that's also something which is very, very noticeable. What else is there? Chazak ve'amatz, right? That's part of the message, either the bracha or the pledge that the author is putting, hinting at the end. This is so obvious that I think it's too obvious to even bear mentioning, except that I think it needs to be contemplated as well, and that is the difficulty of the vocabulary. Just if you skim through the words of Akdamus, you'll discover that pretty much every word is incomprehensible unless you have an English Aramaic dictionary, and that itself, I think, is worth contemplating. Why was this poem written in such an inaccessible language? Now again, we saw that Rabbi David Yitzchaki from the Kol Chazon Ish suggested that it was an introduction to the Targum, which obviously was directed at native Aramaic speakers, and they would not have found this difficult at all. But if you assume, like the other Achronim, that Akdamus was written in 11th or 12th century Europe, when Aramaic was a long unspoken language, so then the question becomes, why is it that the poem was composed in this language?
The Piyutim themselves were composed that way.
Many Piyutim were, yes.
One of the introductions to the Piyutim was done on purpose to prevent the Goyim from stealing the poem.
Interesting.
To
prevent, meaning they didn't want the Christians to rip it off and to use the Piyutim for their own churches. And so it was composed in a language that was not accessible to them. Right? The Art Scroll, actually, in the Art Scroll brief, introduction to Akdamus, they suggest that we don't want to make the angels jealous. Right? We're saying such a grand things about the Jews, and the angels are going to feel that it's sort of like
being slighted. They're being slighted.
Yeah, exactly. That they're going to feel that it's an insult, to them that we're saying such wonderful things about God, and they don't have permission to say that. They're going to feel bad. So better that the angels shouldn't understand it, so we say it in Aramaic. I want to make a different suggestion. Again, there's a number of suggestions I'm going to make today, which I'm not sure whether they're right or not, but I think they may be worth contemplating. And that is that we know that Sefer Iyov is the most complicated Sefer in Tanakh. It's the most complicated Sefer, and we also know that Sefer Iyov deals with some of the most important, the most pressing theological issues of all time. The question of Tzadik Viralo, Rasha Vitovlo, and one of my teachers suggested that it may be that these two things are not coincidental. That when you're dealing with an issue that's of great weight, when you're going to be talking about something which has an easy potential for being misunderstood by a person who's not accustomed to thinking things through thoroughly and deeply, you may deliberately compose it with a very difficult syntax and very difficult vocabulary in order to ensure that the depth, the ideas which a person could easily stumble and misunderstand are only accessible to people who are willing to put in the time and the effort and who have sufficient background to comprehend them. And so it's possible that the very difficulty of the vocabulary of Akdamus tells us that there are very deep ideas, there are potentially controversial ideas that we don't want any audience to misunderstand, and so they were composed in a language that would only be accessible to people who had the background to properly synthesize and absorb these ideas. So that's a possibility. Let's take a look for a second. Let me even ask you the question. So we have the Aleph Beis. We have the Aleph Beis acrostic for the first 22 stanzas, and then we have a message, but not in the same order, just Aleph, Aleph, Beis, Beis, you know, marching on two by two in the last 23 stanzas. What might be the significance of that shift? Right? Why might the author have chosen to, instead of just repeating the Aleph Beis, as Megillas Eicha does, and as many other piyutim do, why might he have chosen to spell out this long message instead of simply repeating, or he could have just done four Alephs in a row? You know, he clearly had a mastery of the language. He didn't have four Alephs, he only had two. He could have done many things. Why might he have chosen, right, to arrange the piyut in such a way that the first half of it is Aleph Beis and the second half of it is something else?
Seems he has names of, for example, Yeparehi's Rabbi Rabbi Yitzchak.
Mayor Beer Rabbi Yitzchak.
Spelling out a name of sense, but I can't find a pattern, but it seems.
I mean, the message that's spelled out is Meir Bir Rabbi Yitzchak Yigdal B'Torah Uvmasim Tovim Chazak Ve'ematz, right? Which is either a bracha, I think that's how our school interprets it, that he is blessing himself, that he should grow in Torah and in good deeds, and that he should be strong and resolute, right? Or it's a pledge, right? Yitzchak Bir Rabbi Yitzchak will grow, right, in Torah and in good deeds, and will be strong and resolute, one way or another. I think that there's a significant difference between the two, but that is the message that's spelled out. But at the same time, I think we can't ignore the fact that he chose, and this is very unusual, by the way, most of the piyutim, when the authors sign their name at the end, they don't spend 23 stanzas signing their name. They'll usually sign their name in one stanza or in two stanzas, maybe in four stanzas or eight, but this takes up more than half the poem. This message takes up more than half the poem. Why did he... So there's two ways you can look at it, but I want to ask you, what's the significance of the Aleph Beis? Like, what does Aleph Beis tell you? Aleph, Aleph, Beis, Beis, Gimel, Gimel, marching two by two by two until you get from the beginning to the end with no interruptions. What does that indicate to you?
Everything is included.
It's very inclusive. There's a comprehensiveness to it. The first 22 stanzas are a comprehensive idea, right? They're not lacking anything, right? As opposed to, you might argue that the last 23 stanzas, not necessarily being in that order, so you run the risk of having some letters dropping through the cracks. There may be something that's missing about the last stanzas. Is there anything else about the difference between the Aleph Beis, just two by two by two by two by two, one letter after another, and the end, which is a little bit more haphazard? I would argue that the Aleph Beis represents a certain orderliness. That you've got two Alephs followed by two Beises, followed by two Gimels. Everything makes sense. There's an order, there's a seder to things. And when you leave the Aleph Beis, so you end up with a little bit of a jumble, a little bit of a disorder. So I want to point out also, keep in mind, the shift happens, right, exactly as we get to the middle stanza, right, of the poem. There's 45 stanzas. The first 22 are Aleph Beis, and then the middle stanza, that middle stanza is the beginning now of the shift, comprehensiveness to having pieces missing, from order perhaps to things that are a little bit more confusing and chaotic. Let's take a look for a second at what exactly is happening in stanza 23. What exactly is taking place in stanza 23? And just in order to understand this, let me give you a little bit of the background of what happens in stanzas 1 through 22. The first six stanzas, which we hopefully will have a chance to come back to a little bit, are basically by way of introduction. The author says, I'm very afraid to say what I'm about to say. We'll have to figure out why that is. But I'm asking permission, and I'm doing it with the proper sense of reverence. And now let me begin. God created the world. The world's an awesome place. God's incredibly powerful in order to have done this. And guess what? I'm not the only one who says that God's very powerful, but the angels say it as well. And by the way, the angels are incredibly awesome. You know, you don't know the first thing about angels, but like, they are just very, very powerful also. But if there's something that's more important than an angel, it's a Jew, and that's why the Jews have permission to do certain things that angels don't have permission to do when it comes to relating to God. And he concludes, if you take a look here on page 335, this is 9 lines up from the Batim, right? After, or 10 lines up from the Batim, it stands a this would be stanza 21, right? You see that it's the Shin right before the Taf. And he says, Shivach Ribon Alma, the Shabbat, right, the praise of the Ribon, Ribono Shel Olam, the praise of the Ribon Alma. It's Amira Dachvasa. It's a very, very pure thing to say. It's an Amira from Amar, which is very pure. Dachvasa is the Aramaic word for pure. And Shifar Alai Lechavoye, it's a beautiful thing for me to point out, Be'apei Malkivasa, in front of kings. I don't think he's talking about kings like King David and King Solomon. I think he's talking about kings like, you know, King John and King Paul, like the Goyish kings who surrounded him. And then as soon as he makes this statement, right, at the end of stanza 21, stanza 22 tells us, Ta'inu mitkanshin. What does the word ta mean? Tashima?
Come.
So this I think is very significant. It's the only place where the word ta appears both at the beginning of a stanza and at the end of a stanza. Right? That's the only place where ta is both the beginning of a sentence and the end of a sentence, which I think emphasizes it to a certain extent. And it may even shed a little light about what is, you know, the significance of having the word ta at the end of every single line. Here we have ta'in umit kanshin, and this is, again, as we're approaching that critical juncture in the middle of a poem where we shift from aleph bays to something else. Ta'in umit kanshin, they come and they gather, kechezu idvasa, like a chazon. Chazon is a vision, an appearance of the waves of the sea, idvasa. Timein, they're astonished, the Shailin lay, and they ask him, their Shoel, the Asek Osvasa, on account of the Osos, on account of the signs and the wonders. And that brings us to the end of the Aleph Beis, right? The end of the Aleph Beis has this Ta, Ta. All of the narrator declares, I think it's beautiful for me to get up and explain all of the wonderful things that I told you about God's power, the creation of the world, the angels, to explain this in front of all of the rulers of the Gentile nations. It's Shefar Alay Lechavoye. I want to, such a beautiful thing to explain. And as soon as he says that, the kings begin to gather in. I guess that they take up his invitation. And they begin then to ask him about these osos, about the signs and the wonders of the covenant between God and the Jews. And here we have the beginning of that middle stanza, the stanza where we transition. What does it say? Minan uman hurichimach. What's the word man? Man de Omar?
Person.
Who, right? It's a who. And what does the word minayin mean?
From where?
From where is your beloved? And who is your beloved? Shapira berevasa.
Beauty.
Beautiful, right? Who's beautiful referring to, by the way? To the Jews. It's referring to the Jews. It's a pun from Megillas Shir Hashirim, which tells us that the Knesset Yisrael, right, will go out, right, and circle around the town, and all of the other Benot Yerushalayim, which allude to the other nations, they'll tell her, right, they'll say, Mado Deich Midod, right, who is your beloved? Right, what makes him more special than any other lover? Hayafa banashim, the most beautiful of all women. So they seem to acknowledge that there is some sort of a special stature to this, the protagonist of Shir HaShirim. She is Hayafa banashim, and she clearly has a lover whom she's not willing to abandon, in spite of the hikuni pitzauni ashomrim and all of the blows that the police are striking to her. Right, but at the same time, they fail to understand why her beloved is so special that he is worth her suffering and her enduring the suffering on his behalf. So they ask, Ma dodeich midod hayafa banashim? And that seems to be the question as well that the narrator of Akdamos is asking as well. Minan umanu rechimach, from where and whom is your beloved? Most beautiful of appearance, Shapira brevasa, Arum begine safis, that on his account you have endured, you have swallowed, Midor Aryavasa. What's an Aryavasa?
Lion.
a lion. So who and from where is your beloved that on his account you have endured the home of lions? So this is a very jarring statement. After having 22 stanzas where we're just contemplating, right, the power of God, right, the beauty of the heavenly realms, the angels, the privilege of being Jewish, and we're pretty, you know, we feel well-founded in it to the point that we say, come on, let's invite all of the presidents and prime ministers of all the nations of the world and we'll tell them what we have just internalized and discovered. And when those presidents and prime ministers show up, instead of listening to our lecture, they show up with some questions. And those questions are, you know, who is this God and why are you willing to suffer so much in order to remain loyal to him? And it's interesting that that's exactly the point where the Aleph Beis sort of breaks down, where the comprehensiveness is lost, where the order, right, is lost. And now we're in a little bit more of a chaotic realm. And the remainder of Akdamus seems to be the answer to this question that is posed, right, by these kings.
Is it possible that you have 22 stanzas is equal to the 22 letters of the alphabet?
That's exactly what they are, because the first two are Aleph, and then the first one is Aleph, the second is Beis, the third is Gimel. Right? But the irony is that the last 22 stanzas, after the question is posed, it doesn't go back to that same Aleph Beis. Right? You might have expected you have 22 stanzas of Aleph Beis before we encounter all of these presidents and prime ministers, then you've got 22 stanzas afterwards. There ought to be some sort of a parallel, right, between the two of them, but that parallel is absent. The first 22 stanzas, while we were just engaged in isolated philosophical contemplation, they've got that, you know, Aleph Beis imprint, and the last 22 stanzas have something else. It's a message of chizuk, it's a pledge of chizuk, right, but at the same time, it does not have that same comprehensiveness or the same order as the first 22 stanzas.
Boaz is insight. Mm-hmm. Yeah, insight.
I just want to mention in the Oscroll here that has a linear translation, it has different translation that gives the it puts a different slant on things.
Mm-hmm.
Like it says that the kings gather in the presence of the wicked. And, one thing for us to look at?
Maybe afterwards. I read the Art Scroll, the Machzor's translation, before I did this. There were many things that I liked about it. There were one or two things that I interpreted it differently. Again, the vocabulary is so difficult that it's hard to prove one way or another. You know, again, like Art Scroll says that the acrostic at the end is a blessing to himself. I feel that it's more likely to be a pledge. A pledge of allegiance, if you will. Yigdal b'Torah. I'll continue to grow in Torah in spite of the adversity, right? In spite of everything else that's taking place and the fact that I've lost, you know, the clarity and the order and the organization of every Beis following an Aleph and every Gimel following a Beis, but I'm still committed. I've still got this Beginei Safis. I'm still willing to endure the Medor Aryavasa, right? Even though not everything is so clear to me.
Okay. What is it again? Twice Aleph, twice Beis.
The first 22 stanzas. If you look at the first stanza.
Why is that?
Hmm?
Also, I think we're suggesting that there's a why is it double?
Yeah.
Aha, interesting. I had a theory about it.
Maybe to make more emphasis on it. No.
Very possibly. Very. I had a theory about it. We know if you look for a second at the third line, right? The third line of Akdamos, right? All the way at the beginning. So he says, "Akdamus milin." Let's actually do this. "Akdamus milin visharayot shuta." Right. So this is I'm gonna introduce my words. I'm going to ask permission. Shari, right, is permit in Aramaic. Shuta for my speech. Avla shakilna. Let me get a license, if you will. Harman reshusa. These are all synonyms for licenses. I'm gonna take reshut. I'm gonna be shokel reshut. I'm gonna take permission. And then he says, "Bivavei terei utlas," with gates of 2 and 3, "de eftach bin akshusa," that I'm going to open with knocking or with trembling. What does it mean, "Bivavei terei utlas," with gates of 2 and 3? It's a very, very cryptic line. What it tells you is that the number is either 2, 3, and 5, which is the sum of 2 and 3. Somehow are the keys for organizing the piyut of Akdamus. Somehow 2, 3, and 5. So I know that the art scroll in the Machzor tells us that there's two different ways that you can split up the piyut. You can split the piyut into two, which I think is what we've done, the first 22 stanzas being the first part, and the second 23 stanzas being the second part. So you have a clear division between half and the other half. Art scroll says you can also, if you look at it from a different perspective, you can split it into three. That's a little bit more challenging to figure out what the split of three is into. And I would argue that the split of three is that you have a description of God and the angels, you have a description of the Jews, and you have a description of Olam Haba, but it's not necessarily the only way you can do it. But when I read this line of Bavei Terei Utlas, this gates of two and three, there was another echo in my head of a pasuk from the Torah. Keep in mind, by the way, that the Akdamos, the author of Akdamos, and the intended audience of Akdamos was presumably very, very steeped in Torah and in Chazal, and so any particular line that resembles, right, something else probably was done with an awareness, if not an intention, that it should call to mind the pasuk that it resembles. What pasuk is going through my mind? Treyutlas. And gates. Al pi shnayim edim u'shlosha edim. Right, that's where you have, right, exactly. Right, so you have a beis din, right, the gate. Then you have two edim, right, or three edim, which makes me wonder whether there's something involved over here that each of these pairs, right, is also almost coming like an edut. Well, in general, the idea of gates and basin are associated with one another. Bisharecha generally refers like Lot Yoshev Bishar Sedom. Rashi says he was appointed to be a judge because that's where the Batei Din used to sit. Again, if that's not what it means here, it doesn't bother me that much. I think that the Trey Plas suggests this idea that there isn't a dot over here. Yeah.
So isn't this just the derech of piyutim, of poetry in Hebrew language?
Right, so there's one thing I think which distinguishes Akdamos from the other poems, and that is that more than half of the poem is occupied by the name, which I think is somewhat unusual even amongst piyutim.
But we've seen Chazak V'Yamavs with a name in Zmiris.
We do see that, yes. Okay. So... And I think that it's worth noting in Zmiros as well, right? It's worth noting in Zmiros as well, but especially over here, right? Where I'll tell you basically like this: when I read this middle line of Akdamos, I said to myself, one second, he just spent 22 stanzas, right, describing, right, the glories of creation and of the heavenly realm and of what the ideal of being a Jew is. And at the end of the 22 stanzas, he says, "I am ready. I'm ready to get up in front of the Malachim and to tell them what's going on." And then the Malachim come. So what I'm expecting now is that he's going to basically repeat, right, what he said in the first 20 stanzas for the benefit of those Malachim, right? But that doesn't seem to be what happens. It seems to be that something else happens, which makes me wonder, like, what exactly is, right? And the shift from the Aleph base to the name appears at such a critical juncture of the poem. Meaning, it's not just that, you know, he ran out of Aleph base and now he's ready, you know, to sign his name. It's that there's a very clear shift exactly where the Aleph base finish between section one of the poem and section two of the poem, right? Which also makes me think that there's something more significant to having the transition at that point. Than just the fact that he decided to sign his name after finishing the Aleph Beis. So what exactly takes place? What is his answer? It's obviously not just going back over the Aleph Beis, saying the Edut, that Aleph comes and testifies about God, and Beis comes and testifies about God, and Gimel comes and testifies about God. Our testimony about God, right, is not coming forward in a court, and we stand up, and we swear, and we go on. Our testimony about God is through our experience, through living the experience of Judaism, through our pledge, right, to be yigdal b'torah uv'ma'asim tovim, right? But what exactly is the content, right? Not just the acrostic of the last couple of verses, but what is the content of those verses? So if you take a look, right, whereas the first series of stanzas is a discussion of the heavenly realms, the last series of stanzas is a discussion of olam haba. You go through them. He tells you this is the reward that the righteous are going to get in Olam Haba. This is what's going to happen right before the end of days. There's going to be a battle between this animal and that fish, and then God is going to slaughter them, and He's going to serve the meat to the tzaddikim at a great feast. And there's going to be canopies, and there's going to be celebrations. Yeah. Exactly. That seems to be the basic. thrust of the last stanzas, and if you look, where is it mentioned on page 335? No, sorry, it's 336, all the way at the top. The first line on page 336, he tells you a little bit about why he's giving this answer. He says, "Revusichon machashiva, your ribui, right? Your abundance, right? Or your rabbanut, your mastery, your authority, machashiva." What chashivos does it have? What significance does it have? Kavel hahi shevachta, when contrasted, when placed opposite, that shevach, that praise, revusa, and what is that praise? It's the revusa, again, which is parallel to the revutchon, right? The revutchon and revusa, the greatness or the authority, the abundance, the yabei li, that he, my lover, right, God will do for me, kadmatya yeshuasa, when the Yeshua arrives. So in other words, your question is, and again, this is the simplest reading of Akdamos, your question is, from where is your beloved, and who is your beloved? Why have you been willing to endure so much suffering on his behalf? And the answer is, because everything that you promised me, if you look at the intervening stanza, you'll see that they basically say, Jewish people, I think you're a beautiful nation. You're precious, you're beautiful. This is the second to last stanza, four lines from the bottom on 335. You're precious, you're yakar, and you're na'e, you're beautiful. Intar vilimarvasa, if you are arevim, which art school translates as get mixed up with, or you could say that it's like arev v'ha'arevna, if you find sweet our marut, like a mar, to be mar means to be a mastery. If you find our mastery, our dominion, sweet, so then re'uteich na'avidlan, like yehirava, your will do for you, b'chol atrevasa, everywhere. And I'm asking, minan v'chimach, where is your lover? Right, we hold dominion everywhere. And if you are willing to make peace, right, with our dominion, say the Malchei Agoyim, so they say we will do your will, right, all over, because we are all over. Okay. So his answer is, at first glance, is whatever you can do for me, whatever abundance of pleasure, of material goods you can give me, whatever greatness, authority, power that you can give me, what's it worth when contrasted with the revusa, the greatness, the abundance, the power that my lover will do for me when the salvation comes, when the Yeshua arrives? And then the remainder of the second half of the poem describes a little bit of what exactly that greatness is. There are, I told you when I first read it, I was expecting a review of the first 22 stanzas. There are a number of significant parallels between the first set of stanzas and the second set of stanzas, which makes me wonder whether the second set is really, in perhaps a little bit more of a chaotic way, simply it is a restatement of the first stanzas, exactly what the Paitan said he was going to do. Shafar alai lechavoyeh, it's beautiful for me to show ba'apei malkavasa in front of the kings, but it needs to be said in a language, right, that the kings can appreciate. If I tell it to them with the aleph beis, right, exactly the way that I organized it for myself, they will fail to appreciate it, and I need to explain it to them perhaps in this in this way in order for them to appreciate it. Now, this happens to allay a different problem that I had, which is that If I could say such a thing, I said to myself, the poem seems to be a little bit condescending, Right? What's happening here? They say, who is God? Tell us a little bit about God, and how come he inspires such loyalty in the Jewish people? Right? And the answer is, you should know, let me tell you what's going to happen. When Mashiach comes, so he's going to give me this amazing steak. It's going to come from a Leviathan. If I want, I can have a fish steak. If I want, I can have an animal steak. And the steak is going to be so good. Not only that, but the ambiance is going to be amazing. It's not just going to be like a steak that you have in a little, you know, takeout, you know, restaurant. It's going to be, there's going to be a chuppah on top. And there's going to be, you know, this incredible, you know, chair and incredible table. And that's going to be, so I'm faithful to God because he promised to give me like a wonderful steak. It seems a little bit condescending. And I think that at the surface level, that may be, again, because he says that I need to repeat over, right, something about God's glory, but in a language, right, that's accessible, right, even perhaps to the people who are the ones who run after authority, the ones who run after acquisition of material possessions, the ones who are b'chal aser vasa, the ones for whom their desire is only satiated by being all over, by possessing this authority, by possessing this abundance of material goods, and in order to convey, right, the message of Akdamos, the message of how awesome and almost unspeakably awesome God is to that type of an audience, you may have to resort, right, to something like a description about the most amazing steak in the most amazing restaurant that God is going to give us, in order to convey that message. But I think there may be something a little bit deeper as well. I think that maybe we'll close with this, or maybe with this and one other observation. The Ramban, in I think it was 1192, was called upon to debate an apostate named Pablo Cristiani. And there are very, very incredible yesodos of Jewish belief that are contained in our transcript of that debate. And one of the points that the Ramban makes, and I believe that many other Rishonim make it in the Ramban's footsteps as well, is that the one of the best proofs that our theology is correct is the fact that the world is not yet redeemed. You'd say in a world where the Messiah has come, so you expect that to be a redeemed world, a world where the prophecies are fulfilled, when Vigar Ze'ev im Keves, the sheep will dwell, you know, with the lamb, right? Variim Gedi your butts, and the lions, you know, will lay down next to the deer, and you know, Velo Yisa Goyal Goy Cherev, and no nation will lift a sword against one another, Velo Yomadu O Milchama, all the military academies will close their doors. So the Ramban says, he says, if the Messiah has really come, he says to the king of Spain, so why do you have soldiers with swords standing by the door? Obviously, the prophecies have not yet been fulfilled. The world is not yet a perfect place. And that's how I know, right, that my God, the God who has not yet sent a Messiah, is the true God, and the God whom you claim has sent a Messiah, obviously, he hasn't, and so he doesn't exist. So I'm wondering whether there's something that's happening here as well, right? Minan umanu rechimach. What's your source? Minayin. How do you know that your beloved, right, is the right one? Yeah, we heard all of your descriptions. God created the world, right? But our God, they say, we think that our God created the world. How do you know that yours is the correct one? And I think that the answer here lies in the parallel between the first set of stanzas and the last ones. The first set says, in the realm of heaven, the realm of the angels, right, and to a limited extent, in the Batei Knesiot and the Batei Midrashot of the Jews, so you find this concept of a redeemed world. You find that people have a true recognition, right, of God and of God's sovereignty and of God's awesomeness and of God's love for us and of our responsibility towards God. That's something that you find nowadays, right, up in Shemayim amongst the angels, and perhaps a limited or perhaps a greater extent in a shul when davening takes place. Kadosh, 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 Hashem tzvakos, meloch al ha'aretz kvodo, baruch kvod Hashem mimekomo, right? Those are statements which indicate that we've got it, right? We've got what the angels have, but if you look outside, That's not what's taking place. You don't see Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzivakos on the billboards in Times Square. The world in general has not got it. We're still living in an unredeemed world. The only time that we're actually going to see it is in Olam Haba. And so the answer is, perhaps a little bit on a more sophisticated level, it's not simply God's going to give us an awesome steak, and you might not understand the fine points of theology, right? But no steak that you offer us can compare to the steak that God's going to give us, and it's worth the wait, right? But there's something a little bit more to it as well, and that is that the very fact that those prophecies of and our anticipations and our hopes for the destiny of mankind have not yet been fulfilled, they themselves are a testimony and an adequate response to the question of minan umanu mechimach. We're holding out for something better, right? We're not satisfied. We don't think that the world as we see it when we walk outside of the Beit HaKnesset and the Beit HaMedrash, we don't think that that world is the redeemed world. It's the paragon. It's exactly what we've all been waiting for. We're holding out for something that is infinitely better. And that's the answer, right? That the revuschon machashiva. What are you offering us? You're offering us that will be the generals of big armies. That we're going to have a lot of people who are holding swords, you know, who are going to serve us and are going to make sure that our will can be done. What is that compared to a vision of the revusa diabeli of the wonders that God is going to do for me? It's going to be not just that I'm going to be able to force my will on other people, but we're genuinely holding out for the hope of a genuinely redeemed world, and I think that may be also part of what's happening. So let me just—do I have another minute?
Sure.
Okay. So just one more moment. I think that may explain the recurrent theme of the ta at the end. So the last couple of stanzas, if you look, and here I'm again going to translate it slightly differently from our scroll. The last three stanzas, starting six lines from the bottom on page 336, says Zaka'in. Kad shmatun shivach doshi rasa. What does the word zakai mean?
Old,
like a zichut.
Righteous.
So zakain, righteous ones. Kad shmatun, when you hear shivach doshi rasa, the praise in this song, kivin kain tehevun behanu chavu rasa, make yourself kavua. Make yourself firmly emplaced in this chavura. In this chabura, in this chevra, right? Join this group, and then v'sizkun diseisvun be'ela darasa. If you do that, you'll merit to sit in the upper rows. Aretet zitun lemiloy. If you listen to my words, dinafkin behadrasa, that I'm saying with glory. What's going on? He's addressing, I think, whether it's himself, right? He doesn't seem now to be addressing the kings anymore. Right? At the end of his address to the kings, he seems to be turning to somebody else. To someone who's a zakai. And he's saying, righteous people, right, people with merit, when you hear these words, please, kivin kain tehavun b'hanu chavurasa. Our Torah translates it as a blessing. I bless you that you should have the privilege, right, to join this chevra. But I think it also may be not just a blessing, but also a plea. Please, right, you've heard the question, you've heard the answer. And I'm hoping, right, that the answer, both the simple level answer that, you know, that, you know, we're, you know, the steak will be delicious in Olam Haba, and the more sophisticated answer that we're holding out for the hopes of a world where it's fully redeemed and not just a world where some people, right, whether they're us or whether they're others, are able to impose their wills on others. We're holding out for something better. Now that you've heard this answer, right, my plea is to you, kivin kain tehavun behanu chavurasa, please sit yourself down permanently, right, in this chevra, and I rate it tzitun lemiloy denafkin behadrasa. If you listen to these words, so then everything else will fall into place. Meramam hu elakin bekadma uvasvaita, that God is exalted both at the beginning, right, in heaven, at the beginning of time, and at the end of time. What's going on in the middle? Well, we're working towards the end, right? But at the beginning that we described at the beginning of the poem, and at the end that we described at the end of the poem, there God truly is the Meramam Hu Elakin. That's what we're holding out for, right? And Tzviva Isvivan, the way that he's chosen, right, to get, right, from the beginning, and to restore that state of the Sof Maaseh B'Machshavah Techilah. How is that? Tzviva Isri Ivan, he desired us, he wanted to form a relationship with the Jews, and therefore Misar Lan Oraita, he gave us a Torah in order to be that bridge and in order to create that relationship. Have a wonderful Chodesh, a wonderful Shavuos.